Okay, we'll bring the, to order the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean? Representative Flanagan? Representative Hertas?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe? Representative Lomer? Representative Lucero?
Here.
Representative Newberger? Representative O'Neill?
Here.
Representative Quam? Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen? Representative Ward?
Here.
And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we'll start out with the approval of the minutes. Somebody want to offer a motion for March 30th minutes? Representative Rosenthal moves the minutes for March 30th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, members and audience, we're going to have a couple of bills up today. We're going to reverse the order and put House File 2690 before us first. Representative Johnson is going to fill in for Representative Kelly. And Representative Johnson, when you get there, we'll go ahead and move your bill.
Mr. Chair, where is this bill moving to from here?
Transportation.
I'll make the motion that 2690 be recommended and referred to transportation.
Okay, you have a couple of amendments. One you wanted to talk about. Representative Johnson.
The first amendment that I wish to talk about, I'm not going to offer this, but it does need to be talked about, is the enhancement of the penalties for people getting caught without having the ignition interlock device on their vehicle when they're required to. I was contacted by my county attorney, Jeff Edblad. They're starting to get a number of repeat offenders on this. I've also talked with through emails with Judge Dean from the 10th Judicial District, who was instrumental in initially getting the ignition interlock devices started, and actually was using them before it was statute. I think it's something that we do need to look about. I've talked with the County Attorneys Association about this issue for enhancing the penalties, and they are going to be discussing it at their next meeting, and at the chair's request, because I do not have their blessing at this time, I'm not going to offer this amendment.
Okay, and your other amendments you wish to offer?
The other amendment, number H2 690, the A1-1. This is a minor change to the bill. It makes it so the ignition interlock.
Representative Johnson, we'll just offer it first and then I'll let you explain it. Representative Johnson moves the A1-1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now to your amendment bill. Thank you.
The amendment to the bill makes it so the ignition interlock device for DWI offenses is strictly used for alcohol-related offenses. In my career as law enforcement, I've had arrested many people for DUI, not just for alcohol, but also for narcotics, and even the tougher one to do is prescription drugs. For those that are convicted for drug-related DUIs, the only way they can be generally done is they have had no alcohol in their system, because if they're tested positive for alcohol, they do not do the test for the drugs in their system. So it kind of defeats the purpose. And we now have people who are getting narcotic and prescription DUIs able to get their license back just by having the ignition interlock testing for alcohol, which they were never charged with. So I think it's a good thing to get this on the bill so it's used in its proper way.
And excuse me for Representative Norton for not introducing you at the same time. And now, was that your description of the bill too then? And
the bill also, what it does is it right now, if I remember correctly, it's three times before it interlock in three times in 5 years, or I believe four in 10. that you'd be able to, in order to get your license back, you'd have to have the ignition interlock device installed on your vehicle. This changes it to the second offense, and so people can get their, you try to stop people from driving while drinking at this.
Representative Norton, before I introduce you, I wanted to acknowledge some of the people that are here today from the Greater Mankato Growth Leadership Institute in the crowd, quite a few people here, and welcome them because I have to take off to do a bill in another committee pretty soon, so I just wanted to say hi and let's give them a hand for being here. So. And Representative Norton is going to speak to us about the bill. She has put a lot of hard work into this whole DWI issue here for the past couple of years. Representative Norton, glad to have you with us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kelly asked me to just say a few words about ignition interlock in general, as I had another bill that I did in his committee already this year, and I think you guys have possession of that right now. I came to the issue of ignition interlock probably 11 or 12 years ago before really anyone was talking about it, and that was because I went door knocking and I met a woman and she begged me, if I got elected, to go up and do something. And I said, well, I've never even heard of this. What is it? And she explained it to me. And basically, as her story goes, she said, my son needs ignition interlock. He has been arrested for multiple DUIs, and he just drives without his license, and I'm scared to death he's going to kill someone. And that was the first time I'd ever even heard of this issue. So since then, I have another constituent who testified in the Transportation Committee who lost a son, and Representative Cornish, and probably some others of you have heard from her. So I dug into this issue a little bit, and I'm just going to share a few data points here. In 2014, 25,258 people in Minnesota were arrested for DUI, 25,000. In 2012, more than 10,000 people died in alcohol-impaired driving crashes in the United States, which is once in every 51 minutes, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. And in Minnesota, 31% of traffic deaths had alcohol involvement. That's 111 deaths in 1 year. 2,040 people suffered injuries, many of them very serious, from alcohol-related incidents. 25 states have now moved toward requiring interlock for all offenders, and that certainly, as the chair knows, and some of you may know, that's my preference. I think it's important to note that a high percentage of drivers whose licenses are revoked or canceled continue to drive, and that alone is the best argument that ignition interlock should be mandatory. On St. Patrick's Day, I was looking at my Twitter feed, and I guess it was the day after, and the department tracks this kind of information, and someone from the I think the State Patrol tweeted that there were 462 drivers stopped in one county, Ramsey County, on that evening. 55 of them were driving with revoked licenses. 55. I mean, it's a huge percent of people that continue to drive. In fact, up to 75% of DUI offenders continue to drive illegally without their licenses. And it's a real problem. Ignition interlock is an effective way to reduce repeat drunk drivers. Some states are finding up to a 50% reduction in drunk driving arrests as a result of ignition interlock use. There's widespread support, and I also wanted to mention more than 500,000 Minnesotans, 607,885, in fact, have DUIs on their driving record. It's 1 in 7 drivers in Minnesota has a DUI, 1 in 16 has 2 or more, and 1 in 35 has 3 or more. This is a significant issue. It can be reduce significantly the states that have moved to more significant ignition interlock laws have seen significant reductions. We should move in that direction too, Mr. Chair. I think this bill doesn't quite go as far as I would like. I think it goes closer to something that this committee can support at this time, and so I'm going to ask for your support of Representative Kelly's bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Norton. Questions? Representative Considine and Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If these people are driving on suspended licenses, how are you going to get them to put an interlock system in their car?
Which one of you would like to answer? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, Representative Constantine. In order for them to get their license back and have a valid license, they'd have to get the interlock device. They're still, if they do not want to get their driver's license back, they're still going to, unfortunately, be driving. But this way is to get them an opportunity to get their license back legally, so they can legally drive.
Representative Hertog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, Representative Johnson. I was looking through the bill trying to find if there was any provision that addresses the situation when many households or families have multiple cars. How do you address that issue in this bill? What do you do to prevent somebody who's had their license reinstated with an interlock in a car, but is that any requirement that all of the cars in that household be equipped with interlock?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertog. The way this works is the person would only be able to drive the car that has the interlock. And that's the issue that I had that one amendment to deal with, and I'm still be working on that, trying to fine-tune that and hopefully get that attached at a later time. But if the person who is required with the interlock drives any vehicle without the ignition interlock device installed, they're in violation of their license, they can get charged with that.
And that's existing law right now, right? This bill doesn't change anything.
That is existing law right now, but like I said, we're starting to get people with repeat offenses of that, and that's something we do need to deal with.
Representative Norton, you had something to add?
I was just going to kind of add a little bit of information here. You know, one of the things that we can, and I would suggest we should do, is require, if you require ignition interlock and not a work permit license, or not allow people to drive without, if a condition of release is that you get ignition interlock and there's a way you can check to see that they got it, that's a start. And that's one of the reasons I support the first offense rather than second. But even at a second offense, you could, you know, you're going to leave and you are required to go down and get that ignition interlock put in. One of the things that I did in my bill, and I don't think it's in Representative Kelly's, but something to consider, is, you know, what do you do when someone is caught driving another car? And one of the things that I tried to do was make, when you get stopped driving on a revocated license, currently it's a payable, and we were increasing that to a gross misdemeanor requiring to go before a judge. I think that would significantly help. Right now, you could, in talking to the Department of Public Safety and a couple of the other departments that I met with over the interim, there are people who have glove compartments filled with payables that they just, it doesn't get taken care of, and so we want to try to avoid that. I think it's something we should address.
Representative Hertog's follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've worked on this DWI issue for the last couple of years, and in my study of it, what I find problematic is there is a high percentage of people who, when charged, don't reoffend. But for that element that does reoffend, they have a problem, and it's an addiction problem. And for some of the victims who have lost loved ones, and for even family members who have had to deal with people who are repeat offenders, one of the themes I heard was the ability of our law enforcement to change the behavior and the treatment part of it. And so I also am concerned about people becoming felons and not changing the behavior. So I support this bill in that implementing interlock after the second one is an attempt to change the behavior more quickly than waiting till the third one and then have an offense and now you're a felon. So I think interdiction earlier in the process of what we have set up in a 4 and 10 kind of system is the right step to do. And just quickly, I know of one case where the family was trying very hard to deal with an individual in their family who was constantly drinking and driving, and he would get, and this goes back more than a decade, would just get his finger slapped, and there was no progressively increased penalty for it happening. And only until he finally killed somebody on the road, then he went to prison for 10 years. And then that finally changed his behavior. So if we can do things earlier in the process, I think it's a positive thing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Powell. Yeah, it wasn't a question, real briefly. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say, I think part of what Ignition Interlock does is a behavior modification. When you learn that you've gone out and you've only had one or two drinks, I believe there are some that are truly alcoholic, and that is what you're talking about. There are other people who just, it takes a while for them to understand what the level is of tolerance for their bodies, and they think they can drive. The Ignition Interlock teaches them as they go when they try to blow into it and say, oh, three is too much. And so I think that's one of the advantages. And plus, the Ignition Interlock can be managed so that you you have to be 3 months blowing into it without any register in order to get off. So you do learn. It does modify behavior.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what my concern is has the interlock technology gotten better? Because I've heard the horror stories of people blowing into these things when their cars are cold, things freeze up, and they can't get to work, and which then drives, pushes them to do something even worse, which means drive another vehicle. And we've had, I've heard the horror stories, and the other side question I have after that is how many different companies provide these? I mean, are we locked in and to a monopoly situation here? How many different outfits provide these devices?
Good question.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, things are getting better. When the interlocks first came out, the only facility that installed them or maintained them was in St. Cloud. And if you were in International Falls and had an interlock, you had to tow your vehicle down to St. Cloud to get fixed. That has changed. There's a lot more of these stations and these facilities across the state, so it's not nearly as bad. And the technology is getting much better than when we first started.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not very comforting to me, and not very comforting to the folks that have to, that as we increase the number of people that have to use these. And what I guess I'm really worried about, because I do know someone that went through this process, and he struggled because he'd blow into it, then he couldn't get to work, and he had to try to find a way to get there. And yet he knew someone else that was charged in very similar situation, and that person chose not to do this and drive without a license and violate the law even worse. And when she got stopped, she got a little slap on the hand and continued to go. You know, the cost of him putting in the interlock compared to the cost of the fine of the person not putting it in, she had a much less fine than even the cost of installing the system. And hopefully this addresses that. And I think this is a step in the right direction, but I'm concerned that we're pushing these systems before the technology has gotten to the where it's not going to cause us more issues in the future. So I hope you're right. I just have some concerns when you say they're getting better. We may be a step ahead of technology, but I hope that that you're correct. Thank you.
Representative Howe, we have somebody from the manufacturer here. Sir, if you give your name and your title, where you come from, I mean, in the business, and then make it brief, if you would.
Thank you, Representative Cornish, members of the committee. My name is Edward Cohen. I'm Vice President of Smart Start Minnesota. I'm also here on behalf of the Ignition Interlock, the Coalition of Ignition Interlock Manufacturers today. With respect to reliability, sir, generally, I would say that our studies indicate that we are at least 99.9% working on any given day. Cold weather can provide some challenges, just like it can to your car battery, to your car engine. We do see a little bit worse problems in the winter, but for the most part, ignition interlocks work. They work reliably every single day.
Okay. Questions from the group? Any other testifiers today? If not, and you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, renew my motion that House File 2690 be recommended and moved on to transportation.
Sure. As amended.
As amended.
Okay, and thank you, Representative Norton, for appearing today and helping out and your work on this issue. And Representative Johnson, thank you. You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you much. Representative Anderson, sorry to make you wait. The chair will move House File 3082 and also to the General Register, and I will move the A160960 amendment, the author's amendment. Okay, to get it in the bill, the proper form that the author would like it. Okay, as to the amendment motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is before us. Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members, again today. The amended bill here deals with some concerns that were addressed earlier, so we certainly hope that the delete all amendment is in a better form and would be more conducive, and it's the way we'd like to have it heard, and you just approved that, so thank you. As key energy providers within the state, Minnesota's utilities are under increasing pressure to protect and monitor our interconnected infrastructure that serves all of our homes, businesses, and industrial facilities here in Minnesota. The issue of security is becoming more important every day in this world of ours, and certainly the electric grid system is one that is critically important to monitor and to maintain security in our state and also in our country. The bill before you, House File 3082, expands what is already included in current law, the current statute, Section 609, that deals with damaging or stealing transmission or telecommunication equipment. And this amended bill would expand that crime to include any energized equipment within an enclosure, any grounding equipment, and any security component. And mainly we're looking at substations as they are scattered around the state, a lot of those in pretty remote areas. And over the last 5 years, by far the most common occurrence of these breaches in facilities on the system was by individuals or groups cutting the fences and then getting inside the substations to steal a visible copper from inside these substations. And that results in a great deal of physical damage, along with the obvious loss of copper and possible reliability to the system. Mr. Chair, I have a couple of testifiers who are far greater experts in the field than I, and I'd like to have them come up and visit with the committee.
Bring them up. And in the meantime, no, this doesn't increase any penalties or change anything. It just expands the area where you can be
correct.
Okay.
The statute is there. It just expands the area that would be included in the penalty.
All right. Thank you. Sir, if you give your name and title and begin.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Cornish and committee members. My name is Andy Snope. I'm here on behalf of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We're the folks that work on these electrical systems, and we're very supportive of this bill. It's our members who have their lives on the line when they show up for work on any given day after a gate has been cut and a facility has been entered and material has been removed. Unaware of the hazards they might face after this damage has occurred, they're really apprehensive to go to work and do their jobs for fear of severe injury or death. So we're hoping that this bill can create even more of a deterrence to those who intend to dismantle an electric facility and put our members at risk. So I would ask you to support this bill. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Okay, seeing none, your next testifier. Thank you, sir. Your name and wait till a little bit. I'll give your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Moran, representing Minnesota Rural Electric Association, the state's 45 electric distribution and 6 generation and transmission cooperatives. Damaged electric transmission and distribution equipment continues to be an issue for electric utilities in greater Minnesota. The damage risks lives, as Mr. Snope highlighted, decreases reliability and costs the utilities and their members in repair expense and loss of service. The current statute seeks to protect against damage to electric, pipeline, and telecommunications equipment essential to the safe transmission and distribution of these services. While the sections on pipelines and telecommunications are quite lengthy and cover all equipment necessary to provide this essential services, the electric service section currently only covers power lines or wires. As you know, there's much more to the electric grid than wires. The current statute simply doesn't cover the electric equipment necessary to safely transmit and distribute electricity. All Minnesota electric utilities, including co-ops, municipals, Minnesota Power, XL, Otter Tail, are working closely with the IBW and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association to clarify the statute. The amended language removes the reference to grounded fences and includes only components used in the transmission and distribution of electricity, including equipment used for grounding, system protection, or personal protection. The equipment included in this clarification is well within the substation fence or located atop the utility pole. Not only is the equipment described essential to the safe transmission and distribution of electric service, but also poses severe safety risks both to utility workers and the public if it's damaged or removed. Please support this bill. It can save lives, increase reliability, and reduce costs for our electric utilities. Thank you.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is probably to the bill author or maybe to legal counsel. So if I'm a 15 or 16-year-old kid and we're out in an area where there happens to be some solar panels and we throw rocks and it breaks a solar panel, would I likely be charged with a felony?
What was the question? If you were what, a 15-year-old?
Yeah. I'm talking about youthful mischief, not what is really clearly something that's set out to do damage.
Oh, anybody who would like to take a shot at that, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd like to take a shot at that. The language in this section refers to the equipment used for the transmission and distribution of electric service, so energized equipment, including things with inside of a substation fence.
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't a solar panel be generating electricity?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, generating, but this would be transmission and distribution. I think, to your point on the kind of useful damage to it, this is targeted at significant damage or serious damage to that kind of equipment, and it wouldn't be included in that.
Representative Dean.
So as I'm reading Section 1, Subdivision 1, Section 3, it says any component used in the generation, comma, transmission, comma, or distribution of electricity for grounding. So if it said any component used in the generation and transmission, then I would believe what you just told me. But with that comma there, I think there's been a clear separation between the generation and the transmission.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct. My mistake. I would say you're right that would be included within it if somebody was going to damage it. The decision on whether or not to prosecute at this level would be left to a county attorney, and the hope here is that this would allow them more coverage to go after things that do result in significant damage to the system, not the kind of youthful exuberance that might result in some sort of damage of that variety. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I actually walked over to nonpartisan fiscal staff to ask, is there a fiscal note on this bill? And if so, is there anything in it that the committee should know about?
Mr. Walt.
Mr. Chair and members, there has been, I guess, sort of a custom in this committee going a few years that has sort of been followed for the most part, but not in all cases, where fiscal notes with a zero cost, I generally bring these to committee to save on printing costs and things. If there's questions, members can ask to see the note. They have not been included in the packets. There have been several fiscal notes of zero the last few days where there were no questions. This bill has a zero fiscal note. I do have a copy. It has not been included in the packet. And if there's any questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, we could change the policy and put all zero fiscal notes into the packets. Some of them tend to be lengthy. They can be up to 20 pages, but it's all at the discretion of the committee members.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I actually put him on the spot because I just learned that that was happening. And one of the challenges with fiscal notes is that a lot of times there's information in the narrative, even if there's not helpful information in the money. And so, Mr. Chair, I guess I would request, as we at least move forward during between now and the end of the legislative session, we certainly can continue to inquire every single hearing whether or not there's a fiscal note. But in the event there are comments on these fiscal notes, it might save you some additional time if we actually, even if just research gets them, so that we know when we want to talk about something versus not.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Ward, and then Representative Payne, and then Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More a matter of curiosity as I'm trying to tie the links together here. How often do you actually, are people who commit these crimes caught? You know, beyond the youthful kinds of things where people tend to talk, if someone is actually trying to take some resources and creating damage in the process, how often does this actually get prosecuted?
Who would like to take that one? Go ahead again.
I guess I can give you a scenario. I don't have statistics on how many people are caught. But typically what happens is these people are looking to scrap out this metal or this copper. So in rural Minnesota, it might be a pickup truck full of copper or material that's recognized going down the road. All the scrap houses are typically put on alert for this kind of material coming. They usually have to have some kind of proof of who they are and, you know, present their driver's license and discuss where they got the stuff, and that's how they catch these people, and I think it's pretty successful, though I don't have any statistics on how successful it is.
Thank you. Representative Dean, followed by Representative Considine.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to follow up my previous question, and I'm not sure where this bill is going, if it's going to the General Register or not, but I would just ask that the bill author and maybe other folks look at the clause that I mentioned, and maybe if we're not going to change it here, maybe they can change it in the Senate before it moves forward in the Senate. Just, I mean, I'm really concerned that I understand the intent of this, but I also understand that there may be a overzealous prosecutor out there that wants to show a young kid an example who may have thrown a rock and hit one panel, which probably is going to be less than $1,000 for the single panel. And that if there's a way that we can somehow do something in that language to make it clear, I would appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, okay. Representative Hilsman, did you have anything?
I just was going to make a comment to Representative Dean. It actually, I think, covers it already under current law with any machinery or equipment or fixture used to receive, initiate, amplify, or process the transmitting. So I think you actually have to change current law to get at what you're talking about. I think this expansion doesn't really change what is there. And they do get prosecuted, and many times they get prosecuted because someone actually nearly killed themselves by trying to cut the copper off live wire or trying to cut the copper out of the transmission lines. I've seen a few of these cases that can have near devastating impact on the person trying to scrap that metal.
So, Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hellstrom. So is that tied to a value of $1,000 or no?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no more questions, the chair will renew his motion to pass or just refer House File 3082 as amended to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Anything else? And we are adjourned.